But to begin this evening, I'm joined by Dr. Ida Milne, history lecturer in Carlow College and a social historian of disease, who has written extensively about the influenza pandemic in Ireland 100 years ago. Ida, as an historian, you've spent 15 years of your life studying the social, the economic, the medical, the political history of the pandemic in Ireland. And you wrote an article for RTE Brainstorm this week about the many echoes and the lessons that can inform the present situation with the coronavirus or COVID-19 outbreak. One of those lessons is how to manage the panic related to the risk of infection. Just give us an idea of the kind of panic society experienced back in 1918-1919.
Well, you know, it has many echoes of today that you see lots of like conspiracy theories. Where did this disease come from? You know, was it a biological terror weapon? In 1918, they thought that Bayer was infecting aspirin with the flu, and that was a kind of a weapon, a German chemical weapon of war as well, you know, that they were trying to fight the war on another front. So all these conspiracies are very common. And panic is also common because people tend to think in crisis situations that governments are hiding things from them. And the way governments...
Well, they were right in 1918 because the reason why we called it the Spanish flu was because people were only aware of the fact that people were dying of flu in Spain, whereas they were dying in the trenches wholesale, weren't they?
Exactly. They were trying to keep it hidden from the enemy so that they wouldn't be weakened and the enemy attacked them where the flu was hitting. So right from the very beginning, I suppose, secrecy is built into the 1918 flu. And then people always think that something is being hidden. So the way governments can combat that is by being very open and making sure that they pass on good information. And the other, I suppose, way they can deal with panic is by making sure that information is really simple to understand. Because if you're ever in a panicky situation, you're trying to make a decision about health, like, for example, phone 999, it's very hard to be rational and to not panic. So you need information that's really clearly understood. And 1918 shows that. For example, the Local Government Board for Ireland issued this notice that you really needed a PhD to be able to read it. And it was full of long words and difficult concepts about disease. Whereas the Dublin Corporation and Sir Charles Cameron, who was a marvellous communicator, and journalists sought him out all the time, They issued really simple notices like, when you get the disease, go to bed and stay there until you're well better. A lot of people get ill from getting out of bed too quickly. Drink plenty. Do something to cure the fever. Really, really simple messages. You actually see that now in the UK and the NHS. They have a really simple drop down message. For, you know, so you can self-exclude yourself in different categories to look at it.
This was something in the way of a perfect storm. And obviously it was great if you happened to be a virus at that stage because you could travel very, very easily. But, I mean, first off, the trenches of World War One, you have literally hundreds of thousands, millions of men in very, very cramped conditions, very, very close to each other. Then that ends. Everybody goes home.
Yeah. And the soldiers, of course, then are kept with the live food for the army, which in those days, like pigs and fowl, are all vectors of influenza. So that's one of the reasons nobody knows where the disease came from for a long time. And then they all go home. They're all shipped across the Atlantic. The Americans, of course, when they enter the war, they're shipped really speedily across the Atlantic.
And what, a million and a half Indians as well?
Yeah, yeah. 22 million, actually, Indians is the latest count. The count keeps changing all the time for India.
But, I mean, would have gone back.
Oh, sorry, would have gone back. Oh, absolutely.
So they spread whatever they've...
The Gurkhas who were fighting for the British in the war. Absolutely. Sorry about that.
And, I mean, do we have any idea at this stage? I mean, I've seen all kinds of figures. Any idea of the numbers who died worldwide from the flu pandemic?
In 1918, it goes up and down all the time. 50 million plus, I think, my colleagues in the international flu community would say, is a reasonable figure, up to 100 million. But we still have no figure for China. We've no figure for Russia because it was at war. We have very patchy figures for Africa and South America. So, you know, it's a rough guide. And I think that's the thing we're learning really from this disease and other diseases. They're rough guides.
And how much of the mortality and morbidity would have been related to the fact that perhaps people would have been after a world war physically debilitated, so therefore more susceptible to a virus?
Well, some people argue that that was the case, but equally one unusual feature of the 1918 flu, which thankfully doesn't seem to be happening now, is that it hit very strong, young, previously healthy athletes and people like that aged 25 to 35, which is one of the things that makes it particularly sad because it's also the age group for parents of young children. So a lot of children were orphaned. But they think that's something called a cytokine storm, that when the body, in very simple terms, overreacts to the disease, the immune system kicks in and overreacts.
And obviously we've just heard that Italy has locked down essentially a quarter of the country. Were there any efforts made in 1918, or more particularly in 1919 when it had really taken hold? Any efforts made to quarantine, to lock down parts of the world?
This is something I'm increasingly interested in. Australia did try quite successfully. They managed to delay it coming in by keeping people in ships off the shores before and checking them for temperatures and stuff like that. But, you know, it's really surprising that we didn't, as an island nation, try to do that. And I think the reason for that, if some eventually we will find evidence to support that this idea was tossed up and then dismissed, because America had come in and we were very into the war, and we were very important for America's effort in the war, if you like, because they were using our shores to and our bases to operate defences against the U-boats and to operate the convoy system to bring ships in and out safely from the war arena.
So not much in the way of quarantine anywhere.
Nothing
okay,
here.
So that's another reason why the morbidity would have been extremely high, because it was allowed to spread rampantly, more or less.
And also our railways were at the highest in Ireland, for sure. Our railways were the highest length ever in 1918.
Yeah, everything was public transport in those days. Yeah, so it made it easier to spread, I suppose. And in terms of infectiousness, contagiousness, whichever is the correct word to use, I'm never entirely certain. How would you compare the two? I mean, I know it's early days yet as far as COVID-19 is concerned, but how contagious was or infectious was
influenza? I suppose
influenza?
The amazing thing about the 1918 flu is that it spread to just about every place in the world. There were some islands, I think, in the Pacific that didn't get it. And it spread in a very short time. Very, very quickly, despite the lack of air travel that we have today. I'm told by a scientist that who I work with, a virologist and an epidemiologist who have been very good to give me information, is that flu is aerosolized and therefore it hangs around in rooms and buildings for longer, whereas this disease is a droplet disease. So therefore, they hope it's not quite as contagious or infectious. So, you know, that it won't spread as easily, but it doesn't seem to be very containable at the moment.
I mean, we also have, it's disputed what exactly the morbidity rate is, because in South Korea, for example, where apparently they have tested a lot of people and they have uncovered a lot of people who might have been suspected of having ordinary flu symptoms, in actual fact have COVID-19. So the death rate is something like, what is it, 0.6%?
Yeah,
whereas in other countries, it's supposed to be higher. But is that due to the fact that not as many people have been tested?
Oh, for sure. And I suppose, you know, the thing we have to come to understand is, again, numbers are somewhat notional, and they give you indications that where the disease is going to go in the most vulnerable sectors of the population. But in terms of an epidemic, you don't know the numbers until everything is over. Mm. And the rate of death, you can't be confident about it.
And what was the rate of death in 1918, 1919? I mean, now I think it's 0.1% for your average winter flu or influenza outbreaks. What was it back in 1918,
1919? We use a rule of thumb in the international influenza as a humanities research community, that it's about 2.5%, which is a hell of a lot bigger than we have, you know, the average for a seasonal flu. Mm. But I've seen lower estimates than that, maybe about 1%, which would still give a much bigger, you know, a case for mortality rate.
I've also heard a lot of people talking about, oh, this will all be gone by the summer. Flu is a winter phenomenon. The good weather is going to end it all. Did that happen in 1918, 1919?
Not at all. This is a flu that actually began in summer, and that's why people found it so surprising that it was influenza, and they thought at first it was a plague. They thought it was some dreadful disease that came out of the war, and that they were talking about a dread disease. And it wasn't, you know, maybe for 4 or 5 weeks that they settled down to actually calling it a flu. So it arrived here in May, June 1918, but had been, you know, in America slightly earlier than that. And, you know, where it was before that, we don't exactly know yet. But it definitely was. Summer didn't seem to affect it all that much.
And tell me about the effects then in Ireland. How many people went down with flu? How many people died?
Officially, 20,057, according to the Registrar General, died from flu. I have added in about 3,000 excess pneumonia deaths to that, looking, you know, taking an average over 10 years. 23,000. I think it's quite conservative because I think doctors were far too busy treating the ill to be that much worried about registering the dead. But from that, I estimated, along with Dr. Anthony Kinsler, who's a medical statistician, that there's probably about 800,000 cases on the island, about if the case fatality rate is 2.5%.
Okay, so you're not starting with a figure of 800,000 and getting 24,000.
No, because
so
we didn't
two
test
and a half,
all those
so
people.
So you're going in the opposite direction.
And so when I counted up the numbers that were ill in the towns and the reports and like that, that seemed about right. It was a kind of a comfortable figure that it seemed to suggest. So what it would do was silence entire communities and towns as it go through. You might see 2,000 or 3,000 sick in a town like, say, Dundalk, or 1,000 in a town like New Ross, all under medical care at the same time. You'd see things like businesses shut down, not because of not because they were instructed to do so, but because the staffs were just gone sick. You'd see the Irish Times writing things like the better sort of client is sending out for their messages just now. Rather than risking themselves, they'd send out somebody to go for them.
Nice work if you can get it. Two of the things, I suppose, that are being talked a lot about this this virus, the economic effects and the political effects. Tell me, you know, what do we know about the economic effects? Just take Ireland, for example, the economic effects of influenza in 1918, 1919.
Well, you see businesses shut down over, particularly the flu.
And not reopening or just shutting down
for a time? They do reopen. They shut down for a time. So they're mostly closed down for maybe 3 or 4 weeks, or they'd be at half pressure for 3 or 4 weeks as the staff are sick and as people are not going out and about and not buying things. And partly that's because they're sick, and partly it's because they're self-quarantining, they're staying at home. Like you hear, I've come across quite a few people who've told me, for example, that they weren't allowed to go out there to, I've interviewed people who'd said they weren't allowed by their parents to go out to celebrate the end of the war in November 1918, which was at the peak weeks of the flu.
Yeah, because that's something that helped to spread the flu.
And it actually did, yeah, because about a week later you can see spikes in the deaths, and that's something I would be concerned about.
So those are parents who were very wise, and those are children, you spoke to those children, and had they gone to the celebrations, they might not have been around to talk to
you. I wouldn't have been talking to that lady at 104, you know.
Political effects, because it's become, I suppose everything is political now, but it's become very, very political. It's been politicised. It's been politicised in Italy, definitely in China. It's being politicised in the USA and probably will be politicised in the UK. And who knows what's going to happen here and to the extent it will be politicised if it spread. Were there political consequences at all?
Oh, well, it's really tied in to Sinn Féin's propaganda. And they're talking about the German plot, people who are in jail in Wales and England. And they say all the time, well, if anything happens to our people, you know, and then this disease comes along, and then they start saying, look, you know, this disease is around, what will happen to our people? Their health is already damaged. And indeed, Richard Coleman died just days before the pivotal general election in December 1918. And some people suggest that it did impact on the election toll, but it probably made people more certain of the way they were going to vote rather than having any big directional change there. But you can always see through the newspapers, even those newspapers which would have been very favourable to the establishment, like the Kildare Observer, for example, the journalists are saying, what are the people in the Custom House doing this? Why are they not being leaders in this? The Custom House, of course, being the seat of the local government board for Ireland, which managed the Poor Law Union Health Medical Dispensary Service.
OK, and which went the way of all flesh a couple of years later when it was burned to the ground by the IRA. OK, and very little treatment available, obviously, at that time. That's one of the reasons why the fatalities
were in a
pre-antibiotic
area, so there's nothing to treat the secondary bacterial infections, which were a big factor with the flu, because the pneumonias were you know, took a lot of the deaths. There is nothing. People don't have a knowledge of things like paracetamol or you know, that they don't have home medications in the same way that we do nowadays. Whiskey would have been a major treatment. Even in hospitals, some of the eyewitnesses, the doctors who write about it, D.S. McNamara, for example, writes about it, and he says that oxygen wasn't used until it was too late. So, you know, thankfully we have those kind of treatments now, even if we don't have enough for the numbers that are being predicted.
And even if we don't yet have a vaccine. Sean Beattie in Donegal text to say the Asian flu of 1958 is a better model for comparison to the present virus. Heidi Mill, thank you very much indeed for joining us this evening. And for more information and the latest updates about the virus in Ireland, as you heard in the news at 6 o'clock, two more cases where you can go to hse.ie.